I teach Civil War Reconstruction History at this university. This fact, when coupled with a rather obvious accident of birth, adds an element of controversy to the reception that my scholarship receives. A decade ago, I delivered a lecture on the rise and the demise of the Confederacy at the Shrine of the Lost Cause, the Museum of the Confederacy. Given the topic, my affiliation with UVA, and the similarity between my first name and the surname of a quite prominent FFV clan, the Armisteds, this particular lecture drew a large gathering of Civil War buffs. I assumed that many of my audience expected an updated version of the orthodoxy about the war, to which polite Virginians are accustomed. I sat somewhat embarrassed in the front row during the customarily florid introduction. When I rose to begin lecturing, polite banter ceased, jaw stiffened, and an eerie stillness filled the room. It was as if a confirmed heretic had somehow managed to slip stealthily into the pulpit at the Temple of the Most Holy. Nonetheless, Virginia-style politeness demanded that the audience sit through the entire presentation. I fear that my lecture removed any doubt about my heresy. The version of the war that I presented bore so little relation to the narrative with which my listeners were so intimately familiar that many of them appeared deeply shaken. Rather than question beliefs about lost cause orthodoxy, a large majority of the older members of the audience seemed hastily to close their minds to my argument that Southern defensiveness about slavery precipitated the war, and that the surrender at Appomattox occurred because Confederate citizens lost their will to win. As I reflected on the quizzical reactions to my person and on the sharply hostile tone affected by post-lecture questioners, it seems clear that my narrative had, in ways then unknown to me, toyed with cherished memories. Grayheads that nodded approvingly when I described the contest as a war for Southern independence changed their alignments rather abruptly when I also insisted that Southern citizens fought to defend slavery. And the warm smiles that greeted my tributes to the valor and heroism of the outnumbered boys in gray who fought to the bitter end vanished swiftly when I argued that rampant popular disaffection and massive desertion robbed the Confederacy of the moral resources needed to stave off defeat. Their icy hostility prompted the following hypothesis. Romanticized narratives of principled Civil War heroism remain vivid parts of the imaginary lives of large numbers of white Southerners. I say this because I subsequently discovered, much to my surprise, that many younger Southerners also experienced visceral dissonance on hearing my theories. I present the Confederate experience as the logical outgrowth of the special character of antebellum society, of the ideological currents that created Confederate nationalism, and of the internal conflicts that led to the surrender at Appomattox. I still recall the course evaluation form, whose open comment section enabled a student of mine to warn other UVA students, and I quote, "Avoid this course unless you're a dyed-in-the-wool born Yankee." I must admit to finding this caricature as a rebel basher quite shocking, since I too take pride in being Southern. Yet I soon discovered that intolerance for new representations of the American Civil War knows no sectional boundaries. I say this because I had an opportunity to present the same lecture to a faculty seminar at MIT less than a month after my appearance in Richmond. At MIT, I encountered a smaller but no less enthusiastic audience, this time composed of Northerners deeply interested in the causes, course, and outcomes of the Civil War. I argued as before that the outbreak of the war in 1861 cannot be understood except as the logical outgrowth of Southern refusal to accede peacefully to the meteoric ascension to national power of a Republican Party, which in 1860, in the person of Abraham Lincoln, had elected its first president. In place of the prior policy of separating the national territories into enclaves for slave and free soil settlement, the newly triumphant Republicans demanded that Southerners abandon all future claims to any portion of the American frontier. Republicans rationalized this sharp departure from the norms of antebellum politics on the ground that slavery was an evil so repugnant to American values that citizens loyal to the heritages of the Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution were honor bound to place slavery, as Lincoln put it, on course to ultimate extinction. Lincoln's narration of American cultural memory constituted a frontal assault against the culture of Southern honor. The imputation that Southerners must accept second-class citizenship because of the essential evil of the institution that defined their way of life was an insult of the kind that a prideful Southern citizenry could never accept. When framed in this fashion, proud Southern citizens felt they had no choice but to invoke rights inherited from the American Revolution, their right to, quote, alter and abolish governments destructive of their interests, and to create a Confederate States of America to defend their claim to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At the same time, however, Lincoln vehemently denied any intent to disturb slavery where it existed, primarily because his party had no idea of how to cope with the blacks who would be freed in case of federal emancipation. I just want to emphasize that because it's sometimes hard to understand dense text. The Republican answer to why they didn't want to have immediate emancipation was not moral, it was simply that they didn't know what to do with the black folk who might be free. And on that ground, Lincoln denied any intent to disturb slavery where it existed. Lincoln's party sought to place slavery on course to its ultimate extinction by denying it the right of expansion. At the same time, Republicans proposed to saddle the South with the burden of coping with an institution doomed because it could no longer expand. It seemed to me then, and it still does now, that pious evasions of the full consequences of Northern racialism undermine the force of moralized criticisms of pre-war settlements. For not only did each of the 13 colonies maintain chattel slavery as a legal institution on the eve of the Revolution, but Northern free people also lived in economic and social marginality analogous to slave South free blacks. When I concluded my MIT talk with the comment that Yankee advantages in manpower and resources were probably not the decisive factors in Confederate defeat, a colleague from MIT arose and asked, quote, "How can you of all people be so pro-Southern? How can you blame us for starting the war? After all, didn't the Northern victory free your people?" End quote. Reflection upon these experiences led me to be thankful for the good fortune of their occurring so closely to each other. To be labeled in the South as anti-Southern on the basis of the reading of a paper which, when read weeks later in the North, prompted cries of anti-Northern bias, gave me a new and balanced perspective. I came to realize that many Southerners cling to memories which maximize their claim to principled heroism by minimizing the role slavery played in the decision to seek national independence. Similarly, I found that many Northerners cling to memories which demonize the South for its pro-slavery stance, while ignoring the blatantly racialist power grab through which Republicans rationalized driving Southerners to the wall. When I stumbled, however unwittingly, into the imaginative realms where regionalized memories of the Civil War reside, I found myself taking heat from partisans North and South. Fortunately, my father visited me shortly thereafter. He reminded me of the old adage that receiving fire from both sides of a heated conflict is usually the surest sign of proximity to the grail. So I continued research started years earlier on the contested meanings of the Civil War era. In 1967, when I began work on a study of the aftermath of the Civil War in Memphis, my mother volunteered to help me sort through a jumble of unprocessed city records. I undertook this grimy task out of a really stupidly naive desire to heed my advisor's injunction to do my research to the bottom of the pile. We spent 2 weeks separating police court records from city council minutes, receipts of the poor relief fund from records of the municipal coroner, and property tax books from birth and marriage certificates. As order gradually emerged from the chaos, my mother looked up from our work and remarked prophetically, "There is just too much to do here. It'll be many a day before you finish writing about all this stuff." Mother sensed my deflated spirits. So she tried to brighten my mood by saying cheerfully, "But once you've got it straight, then finish it someday, I know you will." That was 25 years ago. I completed a 500-page study in the aftermath of slavery, blacks and Reconstruction in Memphis and Shelby County, Tennessee, 1865 to 1890, as a senior honors thesis at Yale in 1969. The effort to reconstruct details of the experiences of emancipation in a single locality yielded important new findings about the adaptations to freedom among thousands of former slaves. Illiteracy shrouded but did not conceal a remarkable story of adaptation to new circumstances, of initiative in the face of adversity, and of achievement far beyond expectations. Free people in Memphis went to work, they voted, they organized churches, they supported education, and they erected a communal infrastructure to cope with vagaries of freedom, such as unemployment, sickness, and death. The mining of municipal, federal, and private records facilitated according a direct voice to common folk whose experiences are generally excluded from post-war studies. When I began revising my study of blacks in post-war Memphis, I set out to answer a deceptively simple question posed by the same thesis advisor I might have who sent me to the piles of paper. How had wartime emancipation in the city of Memphis affected post-war adjustments? I quickly ranged very far beyond Memphis. In order to understand that city's history during the Civil War, I ended up writing a dissertation on wartime slavery in 10 slaveholding states of the Mississippi Valley. During the summer of 1974, I sought insight into the effects the Civil War had had on slavery. After studying the WPA slave narratives, as well as scores of slave memoirs, and recognizing the need for more evidence from affluent slaveholding Southern whites, I went to the Southern Historical Collection in search of firsthand accounts of the ways that wartime events had affected slaveholders' perceptions of the attitudes and behaviors of the slaves. Thus it was that I found myself reading a collection of Civil War letters written by a prominent slaveholder, the Reverend Henry C. Lay, who was serving as the Episcopalian bishop for the state of Arkansas. Suddenly, I came across a document that permanently altered my sense of the balance of social forces within the Confederacy. While writing to his sister in February of 1863, Bishop Lay confessed, and I quote, "As for poor Arkansas, I can only cry, alas, alas. The enemy can take possession of the state whenever he thinks it worthwhile to send a respectable force. Our hills are filled with Tories who resist the conscription law and plunder the loyal men. Our army has melted like a snow wreath and chiefly by desertion. Our reverence has not been alleviated by any success, and we are now chewing the bitter fruit of that American upas, the carefully fostered hostility of class against class." End quote. Even as I struggled to complete transcription of this letter, a multitude of questions literally leapt out at me. What was the American upas to which Bishop Lay referred? What did he mean by the phrase carefully fostered hostility of class against class? What features of the Confederate draft stirred the ire of yeomen from the Arkansas hills sufficiently to foment resistance to conscription, desertion from the army, and armed attacks against Confederate loyalists? And what did all this have to do with the inability to fend off an invasion of Arkansas? The phrase American upas posed an interpretive puzzle. I found that upas is defined as, figuratively, a poisonous or harmful influence or institution. As an illustration of correct usage, Webster cites an incident during which the Tsar censored a poet, Alexander Pushkin, for publishing a poem which described the Romanov monarchy as the upas of Russian society. When I tried to transpose this usage to wartime Southern society, it was not immediately obvious which feature of Southern life the bishop was describing. After some thought, I decided that in all likelihood, Bishop Lay saw slavery as the American upas. Admittedly, this may be a venturesome reading. However, if you will pardon me for a slight digression into etymological terrain, I feel confident that this short side journey offers support for this reading. According to the OED, the first published usage of the phrase fruit of the upas occurred in 1783. Interesting year. The English had just learned about a species of the mulberry tree, which possessed very unusual botanical properties. Not only were the fruits of this Javanese tree said to be of uncommonly seductive beauty, but these fruits were also so poisonous that they laid waste to all vegetative and animal life for a radius of 15 miles. By the 1830s, the expressions upas and fruit of the upas gained wide usage as allusions to deadly toxicity. Bishop Lay made a clear distinction between the American upas and the fruits of that upas. If Bishop Lay intended to describe wartime class conflict as the fruit of the American upas, then I think it highly likely that he expected his sister to infer what he could not say directly, namely that it was slavery itself that underlay the internal conflicts that left Confederate Arkansas vulnerable to seizure by Northern invaders. I say this because the enactment in October of 1862 of a special overseer's draft exemption was the incident that sparked the fury of the draft resistors to whom Bishop Lay referred. Faced with a persistent freedom struggle on the part of the slaves, the Confederate government risked all in order to ensure that slavery, the cornerstone of the Confederacy, survived the war for Southern independence. Conflicts such as those in Arkansas could not and did not go unnoticed. Reuben Davis, a Confederate congressman from Mississippi, wrote the president of the Confederacy in the aftermath of the fall of Vicksburg and the defeated Gettysburg amid the fight of his political life. Reuben Davis's vote for the 20 nigger law was, this is the October 1862 draft law, was this major cudgel being used during the campaign for seats in the second Confederate Congress. Responding to these attacks, Reuben Davis drafted an eloquent plea for sensitivity in Richmond to the perspectives and interests of the younger majority. In turn, this plea provided a penetrating insight into the connections between statutory draft exemptions and the carefully fostered hostility of class against class about which Bishop Henry Lay wrote. Reuben Davis argued, "This war is a peculiar one and does depend for success very much upon its being conducted in such manner as to control the prejudices and approval of the people. We are seeking to establish a government and not to defend one. In a revolution, and this war is in the nature of a revolution, every man puts his neck in the halter and subjects his property to confiscation. Therefore, every man who is able to bear arms should be required to do so, if the pressure becomes so great as to require it. And this is the opinion of the great body of the people." They naturally asked the question, why a certain section of the people should be required to do all the fighting and endure all the hardships of the camps, and finally conclude, it is better to resume their former allegiance than to fight for others. Now, to satisfy them on this subject, you must have no substitutes, no exempts. I know that private interests, and to some extent public interests, demands that there should be substitutes and exempts. But when the indulgence of these considerations is endangering the success of the revolution itself, they must yield upon the ground that it is better that a few interests should perish than that the cause fail entirely. Fortunately for the slaves and their descendants, the Davis administration never found a strategy that would enable the Southern Revolution to preserve slavery while simultaneously retaining the allegiance of its yeoman majority. In the end, the Richmond regime moved to abolish slavery, but it waited until late in March 1860. But it waited until late in March 1865 to do so, far too late to stave off defeat. Thus it was that the Confederate Revolution came full circle, from a war to perpetuate slavery to one willing to participate in its destruction. My assessment of the evidence led me to the conclusion that self-conscious slave activism lay at the heart of the collapse of wartime slavery, and that this disintegration exerted a decisive influence on the outcome of the war. My analysis of the Civil War and slavery in the Mississippi Valley showed that the efforts to cope with the slave-inspired erosion of wartime slavery weakened the Confederate cause, even as the slave-inspired move toward a policy of emancipation strengthened the North. The struggle over wartime slavery would prove decisive, undermining the South sufficiently to cause the collapse of the Confederacy. The discovery that slavery's demise played a vital role in the survival of the American National Union led to my present effort to produce a multi-volume history of the Civil War. I believe that our comprehension of the war will be enhanced by broadening the range of subjects to include non-voters as self-conscious agents in political discourse, and by locating Confederate political discourse in the international context in which its contemporaries understood it. The voices of Black people, so crucial to my work in Reconstruction Memphis and on the wartime South, remain conspicuously absent from most scholarship on Civil War politics. Equally absent are the voices of white common folks and of Confederate women. And finally, most Civil War scholarship fails to take seriously Confederate contention that theirs was a war for national independence and not a civil war. It is my hope that the introduction of new voices and new perspectives will yield a fully contextualized narrative of a war which remains the defining moment of American national experience. The effort to bring these issues and actors into focus has taken me down many enormously intriguing but time-consuming paths, each of which led to confronting yet another mountain of material. Although it has taken me a quarter century, I think I now realize that my mother was suggesting, back amid the sweaty piles of Memphis municipal records, that while research is bottomless, completion would come when I found the conceptual center of my subject, a task which demanded confronting the roles that contested visions of slavery and freedom played in the causes, course, and consequences of the American Civil War. To the extent that American slavery defined American freedom, a war about the fate of the peculiar institution could do nothing other than reignite long-remembered contests about the meaning of liberty. Antebellum ideological disputes, which prepare the way for sectional warfare, turned on rival interpretations of the meanings of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. How broadly to construe the phrases, all men are created equal, and we the people, undergirded the explosively irreconcilable conflicts that made it possible for Americans to make war against each other. The centrality of liberty to American cultural memory impelled all of the elements of society, North as well as South, voter as well as non-voter, male as well as female, and slave as well as free, towards active participation in the contest over the meaning of slavery and freedom that dominated the politics of secession and war. Because these groups occupied distinctive statuses and roles, The contest for realization of their visions of freedom raised the most fundamental questions of social relations to the level of conscious struggle. The war to make black bondage perpetual so politicized the slavery issue that it unleashed an American social revolution. And the outcomes of the war reveal the impacts of the contested ideologies, aspirations, and interests of the constituent elements of American society. Viewing the American Civil War in this broader context gave me the conceptual center to see the interactions between the war and slavery in fullest relief. It turned out that Mr. Jefferson knew of what he spoke when he likened life in a slave society to a perpetual struggle with a wolf, in which it remained unclear whether you had the wolf by the ear or the wolf had you. It seems appropriate to conclude that the Confederacy failed because its government could not reconcile the conflicting interests of its constituent social classes. Because of this irreconcilable contradiction, the cause did fail entirely. And out of this failure would emerge the prospects, the problems, the tragedies, and the enigmas of the post-Civil War era. Thank you.